Hello, and welcome to Ordinary Philosophy Podcast. Here, you can listen to interviews and audio renditions of pieces published at Ordinary Philosophy's website, dedicated to philosophy in the public square and the history of ideas that change the world. For more about Ordinary Philosophy, and to see the photographs and sources and inspiration for each piece, please visit ordinaryphilosophy.com. I'm Amy Cools, creator and editor of Ordinary Philosophy. Episode 115, The Bell Tower, Tower of London, Thomas More, Elizabeth I, and Other Histories, Part 2. Saturday, May 4th, 2018, continued. Simon, Lawrence, and I leave the Queen's House and follow Simon past the Tower Green to the Royal Chapel of St. Peter ad Vincula, Latin for St. Peter in Chains. We descend a narrow stone stairway which leads to a chamber underneath the chapel and find ourselves in a chamber with low, arched ceilings. The room is constructed of stone or brick, perhaps both. It's hard to determine exactly which, since it's thickly painted and plastered in some places. The walls are lined with black tablets with names inscribed in curly script. Before the names, some contain such inscriptions as, "Here lieth the body of," or "To the memory of." A tablet on the north wall, above several of these black named inscribed tablets, explains, "Within this wall are deposited in two chests the remains of many distinguished persons who suffered death on Tower Hill and which were for a time interred beneath the floor of the chancel and nave of St. Peter ad Vincula of the Tower of London, the removal of which was necessitated by repairs and alterations within the chapel by Her Majesty's Office of Works in the years 1876 to 1877. The reinterment of these remains was under the supervision of Lieutenant General Milman, Major of the Tower, a member of the committee appointed to carry out the alterations, April 1877. At the west end of the chamber, near the door where we entered, there's a large alcove with a pointed ceiling, and within the alcove is a large, darkly painted sort of chest with a portrait bust of Thomas More on the center top. It's flanked by two large candles, with one small one in blue glass burning in the center in front of the bust, and two long, narrow holders containing many more small candles below. There are two kneelers directly in front of the alcove, and one off to the left below two framed portrait prints, one of John Fisher and one of More. The large chest in More's alcove is inscribed, "Thomas More, Knight, Scholar, Writer, Statesman, Lord Chancellor of England, 1529 to 1532. Beheaded on Tower Hill, buried in this chapel, 1535. Canonized by Pope Pius XI in 1935. This may be the actual resting place of his remains, or it may be a cenotaph, an empty tomb memorializing a person whose remains are elsewhere, in this case, elsewhere within the chamber. This chamber is where, as Simon confirms, More's body is buried. His head, however, is not buried with it. As was the usual practice for those executed by beheading, More's head was boiled for preservation, then placed on a spike over London Bridge, on the very spike upon which John Fisher's severed head had already been displayed for 2 weeks. They were placed there to serve as a warning to others. More's daughter Margaret, so distraught that she could not bring herself to witness his execution, managed to retrieve his head after it was displayed for some time, my sources disagree about how much time, and the skull was buried with her in Chelsea's old church when she died 9 years later. More and his family regularly attended services at Chelsea Old Church since they lived nearby. Roper's Garden across the street may be on land that belonged to the More estate, where Henry VIII would come to visit More during happier times. The Moore Chapel in Chelsea Old Church is among the few sections that stand today after surviving the 1941 bombing that reduced most of the church to rubble. The church has since been restored to nearly its original appearance. Moore's head and Margaret's body are no longer buried there, however. After Margaret's husband and Moore's early biographer William Roper died in 1578, their remains were all buried together in the Roper family vault at St. Dunstan's Church in Canterbury. Next, we ascend the stairs from the low light of the burial chamber into the bright sunshine, then enter lovely St. Peter's Chapel proper. Simon tells us stories about many things found in the chapel and people buried within it. While they're very interesting to hear, I won't include them in this account since they're unrelated to the subjects I journeyed here to explore. St. Peter ad Vincula was first converted from a simple parish church when the tower walls were extended outward in the 11th century, placing the church within its walls as the complex was enlarged. Henry III expanded and redecorated it as a royal chapel in the 13th century. Though it had remained in use, the chapel had fallen into a sad state of repair by the later half of the 19th century. The extensive restoration of 1876 to 1877, which had led to the aforementioned reburials in the chapel's subterranean chamber, also removed many of the 17th and 18th century additions that gave the chapel an ornate but dark and crowded look. Today, the interior has a bright and airy look while still very decorative, with its arches and stained glass windows, a significant improvement. The names of many famous persons buried in and below the chapel are listed on a scrolled brass plaque on the wall near the front door. They include among them, in the order listed, John Fisher, Bishop of Rochester, Sir Thomas More, Queen Anne Boleyn, Thomas Cromwell, Earl of Essex, Queen Catherine Howard, Sir Thomas Arundel, his name is carved into the walls of the Beauchamp Tower in numerous places, John Dudley, Duke of Northumberland, and Lady Jane Grey. After touring the chapel, we part ways from Simon for about a quarter of an hour. He discovers that he needs to fetch a key from his colleague in order to visit our next destination. Lawrence and I bask in the sun and talk over what we've seen and heard thus far. What an adventure, we agree. When Simon returns, we head back past the Queen's House toward the Beauchamp Tower. Speaking of Lady Jane Grey, Simon points out a darker brick building on the way back past the Queen's House. It's a three-story structure, not including the low attic rooms beneath its pointed gables, with brightly painted blue doors. Through the smudged windows, I see evidence of its use, at least in part, as a storage space. Before it can welcome visitors, the building needs to be restored, says Simon, and there are plans to do so. This is where Lady Jane Grey stayed during her brief 9-day reign, from July 10th, 1553, when she was proclaimed queen after Henry VIII's son Edward VI's early death, until July 19th, when Henry VIII's eldest daughter Mary was proclaimed queen by her supporters. Mary won out, and Jane was then held here until executed 7 months later. Jane Grey was a distant cousin of Mary. Jane was Henry VIII's great-niece. Although Mary was the next in line to the throne after her younger brother Edward, according to Henry VIII's third and final act of succession in 1543, the dying 15-year-old king named Jane Grey as his heir in hopes that foreign powers would not gain access to the throne through marriage to his elder sisters. This wasn't just a matter of international politics, however. The Protestant Edward was anxious to keep the throne in Protestant hands, and Mary was a committed Catholic. When Mary took power, Edward's fears were realized. She released all of the Catholics still imprisoned since Henry VIII had had them arrested, and worked to return England to the Catholic fold. Mary did not want to execute Jane. She was actually very fond of her, just as she was of her little brother Edward, despite their religious differences and despite the fact that they were rival claimants to the throne. Jane was persuaded by her husband Guildford Dudley, her parents, and her ambitious father-in-law, the Duke of Northumberland, to take the crown according to Edward's wishes. Mary held the view that many historians still do today, that Jane was an unwilling pawn used to further the interests of power-hungry family members and their connections. Some, however, believe that Jane was more ready and willing to be queen than many of her later chroniclers would admit. She was, and still often is, portrayed as an innocent martyr to duty, family, and religious conflict. It is true that she was forced into the marriage with Dudley, that she harshly condemned her father-in-law Northumberland's power grabs, and supported Mary's ascendancy to the throne. So Mary was more than willing to spare Jane's life, though she did keep her imprisoned in the Tower for security's sake. But during her imprisonment, members of Jane's family and their connections continued to involve themselves in plots to undermine Mary's reign, and in the interest of removing these persistent threats around their Protestant figurehead Jane, Mary felt forced to act. Jane was executed on the same day as her husband, on February 12, 1554. According to eyewitness accounts, after watching, at her own insistence, her husband's execution, Jane faced her death stoically, proclaimed her innocence firmly but not self-pityingly, and held fast to her Protestant beliefs. Her father-in-law, Northumberland, had already been executed the previous August. Her father, Henry Grey, Duke of Suffolk, was executed 10 days later, after having taken part in one too many anti-Mary conspiracies. In the long run, Edward VI's hopes of England continuing as a Protestant country were realized. The unpopular Mary I died on November 17, 1558, after only a 5-year reign. Her younger sister, the daughter of Anne Boleyn, who ascended to the throne as Elizabeth I, broke the pattern her siblings had set of dying after very short reigns. More about Elizabeth shortly. As we continue past the Queen's House, Simon points out the upper sections in white plaster supported by dark wood beams, in that classic Tudor style. It was originally built as a living space for Anne Boleyn, Henry VIII's second wife, and the reason he broke off communion with the Church of Rome, but it was not to be used as such. Instead, Anne was imprisoned there for about 18 days before her husband had her executed on May 19, 1536, not even 1 year after More was executed in part for opposing her marriage to Henry VIII. I've decided not to tell the story of Anne Boleyn here. There's been a glut of Anne Boleyn-related documentaries, miniseries, and television specials in the last several years, and I feel a bit of Boleyn-related fatigue at this point. There's also a 5-day-a-week, twice-daily reenactment here at the Tower of Anne's, quote, tragic final days at the famous fortress, from her imprisonment and interrogation through to her trial and execution, according to the Tower of London's website. During our later Tower explorations, we see the troops' retinue, beautifully costumed and equipped, make the solemn march behind the Faux Anne from the archway leading from the Traitor's Gate up to the Tower Green. Though I won't tell her story, she will figure in the next one, though. So, to continue, we follow Simon through the Beauchamp Tower door and up a narrow spiral staircase. There's some uncertainty as to whether Simon had been given the right key, but after a little fumbling with its inability to smoothly open the lock, it gives way, and we step out onto a long balcony walk with a crenellated wall running along the tower greenside. This walkway leads from the Beauchamp Tower to the upper chamber of the bell tower, no longer accessible by the old small staircase that had been there in More's time. Simon confirms that this is the walkway commonly known as Elizabeth's Walk. Princess Elizabeth, daughter of Henry VIII and his second wife Anne Boleyn, younger sister of Mary, and older sister of Edward, was held here in 1554 following the Wyatt Rebellion. This was one of those in which some of Jane's family and connections were implicated, though the purpose of this one was to prevent Mary from marrying the Catholic Philip of Spain and to put Elizabeth, not Jane, on the throne. A few weeks after the plot was foiled and many involved in it were imprisoned and executed, Mary had Elizabeth committed to the Tower. Unlike Jane and Edward, Mary did not particularly like Elizabeth. Religion must not have been that much of an issue, since Mary loved her brother and cousin despite their religious differences, though it may have contributed. Rather, sibling rivalry likely had much more to do with it. Sibling rivalry of a very particular sort, exacerbated or perhaps entirely created by the adults in their lives. When Henry VIII divorced Catherine of Aragon and married Anne Boleyn, he had Mary declared illegitimate as an additional way to bolster the perception of legitimacy for his new marriage. After Anne bore Elizabeth, the new princess and heir apparent was given the honors and retinue that was stripped from Mary, who was required to stop referring to herself as princess. Though she could do nothing about the other indignities of losing her place in the royal household, she refused to recognize her demotion to Lady Mary. Henry VIII was angered at his daughter's stubbornness in this matter and punished her for it in various ways, but she would not relent. He may have recognized and even come to respect that the steely will Princess Mary exhibited echoed his own, and over time he softened in his stance toward her. As we continue along Elizabeth's Walk, Simon explains that evidence could not be produced that was sufficient to legally convict Elizabeth for her purported connections to plots to undermine or overthrow Mary's reign. I think this was true for the court of public opinion as well. Immersed in the constantly shifting dangerous royal sand trap that was the Tudor family, the highly intelligent Elizabeth had grown wise and wary very early on. She was just too canny to accept communications from suspicious persons. But, says Simon, since she lied at least by omission, since she knew about the plots, Elizabeth was technically guilty. Mary would have been far more legally justified in executing Elizabeth than Jane, and nearly did so more than once, but she had reasons to hold back. One, it seems, was her religious compunction against killing her own sister. Another was Mary's realization that she was growing increasingly unpopular, and she was afraid of rousing support for Elizabeth and the Protestant cause by making a martyr of her. Simon tells us that Elizabeth was the only prisoner ever held in this room to survive their imprisonment here. Then Simon opens the door to the bell tower's upper chamber, and we enter. In this rough-walled stone room, Princess Elizabeth was held for a time. All told, she was imprisoned in the tower from mid-March to May 19th of 1554, but according to Patrick Collinson for the Oxford Dictionary of National Biography, she was held for much or most of that time in the aforementioned nearby upper-floor apartments turned prison built for her mother Anne Boleyn, where the Queen's House now stands. Perhaps this thickly built, secure upper room of the bell tower we're in now, above Thomas More's cell, and the same one which reportedly held John Fisher in 1535, may have been the room in which Elizabeth was initially held, or held any time there seemed to be a danger of her rescue or escape. Next, Simon leads us down a tiny hallway off to the side of the main chamber. Perhaps, I'm guessing, it leads to where the old communicating stairway was. Whatever its original purpose, we find something very much unexpected. A toilet. Not just any toilet, it turns out. Simon explains that this room was readied as a possible place to hold Adolf Hitler upon capture. Hitler's imprisonment here never happened, and this toilet was therefore never used. And so, here it remains. I'm a little surprised it was never removed, given its architectural incongruousness and the general depressing creepiness it evokes, but I suppose it's just too interesting a historical reminder of that time of England's crisis, tenacity, and triumph. Simon has other interesting stories to tell us about World War II and about his military history in general, which particularly fascinates Lawrence. At one time, Simon says, he guarded the imprisoned Rudolf Hess, Adolf Hitler's right-hand man, for 3 years as I remember. Held in the Queen's House for 4 days in May of 1941, Hess was the Tower's last high-profile prisoner, as historian Tracy Borman writes. I won't go into Simon's stories of Hess and other military affairs here, as they're unrelated to my quest here, but it's a great starting point for digging into more of the long and fascinating history of the Tower. Returning to the main chamber, I spot a framed document upon a table, leaning against the southeast wall, and move in for a closer look. It's entitled Years of Peril, and it's neatly written by hand in an old-fashioned script, in black highlighted in places with red and surrounded by a green leafy decorative border. In many places, the document is wrinkled and the ink has run from the damp. It's a great overview of the history we've just considered, laid out as a timeline. It reads, 1533, Whitsunday, which is the 1st of June. Queen Anne goes to her coronation from the Queen's House. 7th September, Princess Elizabeth born at Greenwich. 1536, 19th May, Queen Anne to her execution and burial in the Chapel Royal of St. Peter ad Vincula from the Queen's House. 1553, 6th July, King Edward dies at Greenwich. 10th July, Northumberland proclaims Lady Jane Grey, now married to his son Guildford Dudley, as Queen. They enter the Tower. 3rd August, Queen Mary welcomed to London and enters the Tower. 22nd August, Northumberland executed on Tower Hill. 1st October, Queen Mary goes to her coronation from the Tower, having made 15 nights of the Bath. 31st October, Queen Mary announces intention of marrying Philip of Spain, arousing widespread opposition. 13th November, Jane and Guildford Dudley condemned to death. No apparent intention to carry out sentence. Guildford in Beauchamp Tower, Jane with yeoman jailer's wife. 1554, 25th January, Sir Thomas Wyatt leads Protestant rebellion from Kent, bombards the Tower from Southwark. 27th January, Princess Elizabeth, though ill, ordered from Ashridge to Whitehall under escort. Queen Mary refuses to see her half-sister. 7th February, rebels defeated at Ludgate and Charing Cross. Wyatt captured. 12th February, Guildford Dudley executed on Tower Hill and Jane on Tower Green. They are buried by the Chapel Royal altar with their fathers. 6th March, proxy marriage of Queen Mary to Philip of Spain. 18th March, Princess Elizabeth brought by water to the Tower. At the water, or Traitor's Gate, Princess Elizabeth says, quote, here landeth as true a subject, being a prisoner, as ever landed at these stairs. At the Bloody Tower Arch, when the yeoman warders say, God preserve your grace, she replies, quote, I come no traitor, but as true a woman to the Queen's Majesty as any is now living, and thereon I will take my death. Imprisoned in the upper chamber of the Bell Tower, being supposedly involved in the Wyatt plot, Kate Ashley, her governess and companion, quartered elsewhere. Interrogated by Bishop Gardiner and the council. In view of her poor health, permitted to walk on the battlements, still known as Elizabeth's Walk, past her mother's old room. Robert Dudley, later Leicester, still imprisoned in the Beauchamp Tower. Princess Elizabeth is permitted to walk in the Privy Garden, now Tower Green, escorted by the constable and lieutenant. Dines with them in Queen's House, but a little boy, who brings her flowers, is denied access. 11th April, Thomas Wyatt executed on Tower Hill, having exonerated Princess Elizabeth. 19th May, Princess Elizabeth released from the Tower, conveyed under escort to Woodstock through demonstrations of loyalty to her. 1558, 17th November, Princess Elizabeth proclaimed queen on Mary's death and begins her glorious reign. 1559, 15th January, goes to her coronation from the Tower. 10th May, 1982. 30 years after her accession, Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II was entertained by Her Royal Highness, the Princess Margaret, Countess of Snowdon, in this upper bell chamber. Together they paced Elizabeth's Walk, mindful of the imprisonment of the first Princess Elizabeth here, dined in the Queen's House, and attended the ceremony of the keys. In the end, not only was Edward VI's hopes of England remaining Protestant realized, his fears of a foreign prince taking power in England through marriage to one of his sisters came to naught. As her early chronicler William Camden described, Elizabeth was courted vigorously and widely by princes and aristocrats all over the Western world, some of whom she was personally fond of, and many of which could have helped replenish England's exhausted coffers and bolster its world influence. Yet she refused all of them. Her determination to remain single followed a severe bout of smallpox in 1562, which nearly killed her. Such crises have a way of centering the mind and inspiring one to firmly establish priorities. As Camden reports, the next year Elizabeth replied to Parliament's urging that she take a husband and produce heirs, quote, "Yeah, to satisfy you, I have already joined myself in marriage to an husband, namely the Kingdom of England." And behold, as she takes a ring off her finger and shows it to them, "the pledge of this my wedlock and marriage with my kingdom." And to underscore her determination to rule with authority in her own right, dominated by no man, Elizabeth continued, quote, "But I command you that ye have not appointed me a husband, for that were most unworthy the majesty of an absolute princess, and unbeseeming to your wisdom, which are subjects born." Elizabeth I was known through her long reign and ever after as the Virgin Queen. After I do some photography, we leave the chamber through a little door, climb another little stairway, and emerge onto the rooftop of the Bell Tower. The views up here are amazing, especially on this bright sunny day. The scattered clouds are puffy, the sky is a bright clear blue, and London is gleaming. We enter the pointy roofed cupola and examine the old bell within. Simon tells us that this bell, once rung at executions, is now rung twice daily at curfew. We take in the views, talking all the while. Simon answers my questions about the histories I'm telling here and about good resources for researching my stories. He also tells us more interesting stories from his military career and of military history in general, Again, outside of the scope of this piece. As we go down, on our way out of the bell tower chamber, I spot a section of stone that's been inscribed and covered with a protective clear covering of glass or plastic, and a black slate underneath it with a transcription strapped to the wall. In answer to my question, Simon tells me that there's a tradition that it was carved when Elizabeth was imprisoned here, but it's not really known just who carved it. Both texts are worn and somewhat difficult to read. Here's my best attempt to decipher what they say. In forge were strange, my troth was tried, yet of my liberty ye denied. Therefore reason hath me persuaded, did that patience must be embraced, though hard or unchasteth. Me with smart, and then it seems to be worn off at the end, not sure what it says, yet patience shall prevail. The gist of its meaning seems to be that the writer's integrity was attacked and tried through the inexplicable circumstances of fortune and imprisonment. Though imprisoned, however, they decided that patience must be embraced and that it would prevail in the end. We leave the bell tower, and in the courtyard near Tower Green, we thank Simon profusely and we all say our goodbyes. Then, accompanied by Lawrence, I continue my tower quest in the places that are accessible to us without official accompaniment. There are so many more fascinating aspects of these stories to be explored, and we press on. To be continued. Ordinary Philosophy's website and podcast are independent and ad-free, and depend on support from patrons and listeners like you. To find out more about how you can contribute to Ordinary Philosophy, please visit the Subscribe, Submit, and Support page today. And if you enjoy what you read and hear at Ordinary Philosophy, please share with those you believe will enjoy it too, and take a moment to rate and review this podcast on iTunes. And thanks, as always, for listening.